Kevin Scharf and Jeff Dexter, sharing their sentiments about preserving the Skinner's Falls Bridge in Milanville, Pennsylvania. And to Kathy Dawkins and Debbie Burke from Calico Geese Quilters. Thanks for listening local to Farm and Country and supporting Radio Catskill. Listen to us on air and on your smartphone. Stream us live on our webpage, wjffradio.org. We are Radio Catskill, local news, culture, conversations, and NPR.
I'm Callison Stratton, a singer-songwriter, public historian, and host of Liberation Station here on WJFF Radio Catskill. Liberation Station is a show that highlights the work of female and femme-presenting performers across genre and time. It's my little way of balancing the scales of representation on the radio. Join me for Liberation Station every Saturday evening at 7 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
A very different media landscape greets this new Trump White House, and some observers see the meek coverage of the inauguration as a harbinger of what's to come.
None of the CNN anchors pointed out that Donald Trump is the first convicted felon to take that office. They didn't point out that he was twice impeached.
Plus, what's the deal with President McKinley? It's all on this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Radio Catskill.
If it's happening here, it's on Radio Catskill. Local events, local voices. Live local conversations 5 days a week. Radio Catskill. Weekday mornings at 10.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.
Hi, everyone. This is Greg Triggs. I have interesting friends who are always up for a good conversation about the things we should be talking about together to learn and inform, to inspire, to make our little world a bigger place in Sullivan County, in New York State, in the United States, and around the world. It's time for Travels with Triggs.
Travels with Triggs. Now what's he gonna talk about? Where we gonna go? Travels with Triggs.
I saw the film Edge of 17, a coming-out story about a boy in my own era that took queer storytelling to a new, unapologetic level. It was honest, real, and inspiring. Years later, I was invited to interview Todd Stevens, the director of that film, as part of our Big Eddie Film Festival. We ended up becoming good friends, and I'm interviewing him again. Today, we're going to talk about following your passion, queer identity, storytelling, writing, advocacy, and what lies ahead for our community. Please welcome the director of Edge of 17, another gay movie, and Swan Song, Todd Stevens. How you doing, Todd?
I'm great, Greg. Great to be here. Hello, everybody.
Thank you so much for joining us. First thing I want to talk about is, can you kind of give us a little insight into how you approach creating the world of a film and directing it?
A lot of times it starts with a feeling. A lot of times it's inspired by a song. I will start to kind of like make a playlist, which is just kind of capturing a certain emotion that I might be feeling at the time. And, you know, just start adding songs to it. And a lot of times, like, out of that process start to come ideas, and like an idea will come into shape. Ideas are the hardest thing. Good ideas are the hardest thing to find, I feel, in what we do as writers, you know, like getting inspired with an idea that you're willing to spend 5, 10 years, whatever it is, like getting the film made, you know, that it's something you're that passionate about. And because I've done it a number of times, I know everything it takes to make a film happen. So finding like the good idea that I'm willing to kind of die for, it doesn't happen every day, unfortunately. And A lot of times the idea will come when I least expect it, like I'm taking a shower or the bathroom or something like that. And boom, like it just like it's like those moments when you're not really thinking about something that something almost like by divine intervention can like pop into your head.
So you find inspiration in your own nude body.
Exactly. On the toilet. Yes.
Okay, exactly. Good. Now, I want to go back to something you said at the beginning of that answer, and that is the concept of feelings leading you to story. And you are a noted gay storyteller and filmmaker. And one of the interesting things about that is, at least for men of our era or gay people of our era, our community, I feel like our feelings were suppressed. And yet your work is built on exploring those feelings. How did you start to overcome that suppression to give yourself permission to lead with feeling and story?
I think part of it was almost inspired by the movies that I grew up watching, like coming of age movies that I grew up watching as a kid that were not queer, you know, things like Risky Business or Fast Times at Ridgemont High or the John Hughes movies. And I just thought to myself, I want to make a film that I would have liked to have seen as a queer kid. You know, I think that's really what started it all. I pitched Edge of 17 as a gay Pretty in Pink. Being a writer, it's like you can't not do it. I just got so sick of like not making a film that I couldn't stand it anymore. And I just made a film.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the protagonists of your story is almost seem to be following a chronological trajectory, right? You look at the teenager in Edge of 17, you look at the young adults in another gay movie, you look at Swan Song, which is certainly further along than you and I are, but you are kind of charting a timeline in some ways.
I think a lot of what my mission is as a filmmaker is to kind of like comment on the queer experience, you know, like through my own life experience. And I do need to like circle back to like middle-aged. I'd like to think that I'm middle-aged still. I mean, you know, I plan to live to be 100 and something. but yeah, I sort of skipped the middle-aged part. Actually, that's like a film that I have on one of my playlists, you know, a story kind of like based on people of our age that, you know, have made it through to the and survived to this point and kind of exploring that time of my life. I don't know if I answered that question, but
I think you did.
Okay.
I say you did, and it's
thank you, darling. Damn it. Thank you. Thank you.
As a filmmaker, you know, you've mentioned some titles that were more mainstream or general public in terms of the storyline, who they were about, that type of thing. Who are some of the filmmakers that you didn't mention that inspire or continue to inspire you?
Definitely John Waters inspired a certain style of movie that I've done, you know, like rebellious, crazy, queer, in your face. He's definitely one of my idols. One filmmaker that has inspired me a lot in the past and continues to is Andrew High, who did a TV show called Looking. I think he did a film years ago called Weekend, which is kind of like a 24-hour love story, queer love story, which is something that also that I really have in my mind that I've never really made a love story. And I really yearn to do that. But his newest film, All of Us Strangers, which really dealt with what we're talking about, like people kind of our age that have grew up in a world that where queer marriage did not exist and where our friends and neighbors were dying of AIDS around us. And now we've, you know, survived all of that and are sort of grappling with the demons of our past. Oh my God. If you haven't seen the movie, All of Us Strangers, it is really, to me, it was my favorite film of last year.
It's so good. I saw it three times, twice at the Calicoon Theater and then once on a plane.
You did, really? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And every time you see, I saw it twice in the theater. And I mean, each time it's like you see new stuff.
Yeah, it's like getting punched in the gut in a different way. It was such a, it was such an emotional story. And one of the things I liked about it is it was definitely a queer story, but it was also about being an injured son. And it was also about healing and moving on from trauma against the primary relationship. I loved that about that.
Me too. Dealing with loss and death and... yeah, I mean, I, when I saw it in the theater, like Tim, like my husband, Tim nudged me and looked around and everybody was in tears, you know, not just people that were middle-aged gay men, there were young people there and all kinds of people. And I agree. It really, it's really a subject that a lot of people can relate to. I think that's another goal of something like with Swan Song that I wanted to do is, yeah, it's definitely the queer experience, but also have it also relate to not just a queer audience.
Now, that brings up a great transition because you mentioned the television show Looking, and Looking drove me nuts. I felt as though it was asking for permission from the audience instead of telling a story strongly that would find its audience. I felt like it was apologetically gay. And one of the things I was struck about the first time I saw one of your films is I used it in the introduction. Your film was unapologetic. You brought your experience and expected the audience to come along. You weren't apologizing. You weren't saying please. And how do you think you developed that strength as a filmmaker?
I don't know. I mean, it really almost gets back to this question of how did I at 17 in 1984, sorry to date myself, but how did the 17-year-old kid in a small town in Ohio come to terms with the fact that he was queer and accepted it, you know? And, you know, we'd like to think that nowadays it's so much easier for kids. But I just produced a short film for my friend Bobby Abate that one of the lead actors is 22. And he grew up Mormon, but moved to New York City and was like in the closet at NYU for 3 years or something like that. And we'd like to think that everything is so much better these days. But the fact is, it's still a challenge for so many kids. But why was I a million years ago kind of okay with who I was? I don't know. I've been thinking about that. I mean, was I born that way or nature, nurture, all that? I mean, At Edge of 17 was based on a summer where I worked at an amusement park while these older queer people that were role models to me. You know, I wonder how my life would have been had I not met those people that told me that it was okay. So a lot of it's chance, a lot of it's like DNA. I'm not really sure, but I always was pretty unapologetic about who I was, and thank God, you know.
One of my favorite things to do with you is watch you not be able to filter yourself in a conversation that is of different opinions. I love watching you lay it on the line. I love that in real life. And I love it in your films. And you can look forward to more of that quality in just a few minutes, listeners, because Travels with Triggs will be back soon.
Travels with Triggs.
This Week in This American Life. There are certain questions people use on dates that are litmus tests, proxies for other questions that people really want to know the answers to. A big one?
It's what do you think of Beyonce?
Yes, I am aware of the Beyonce question.
Have you experienced this?
Yeah, I've experienced it many times.
Questions that contain other realer questions this week.
Saturday at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, this is DJ Chucks of Old School Sessions. Please join me and Selector Starkey at our new time, 8 p.m. to 12 a.m. Saturday night.
Old school, baby. Old school, baby. Old school, baby.
That's Old School Sessions right here on WJFF, 8 to midnight, Saturday night, only on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panel took on the Village People performing their hit YMCA at the inauguration.
They also said that this is the last living member.
Yes.
So it's just why.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the show that's not so much about why as WTF. This week with special guest musician MXM Tune from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Travels with Triggs. And we are back, everyone. Travels with Triggs is talking with filmmaker Todd Stevens. Now, Todd, after the accomplishments of Edge of 17 and Swan Song, which I believe is still streaming on Hulu and is an incredible film for those listening who may not have seen it, what are your future goals? What are you moving towards now after the success of Swan Song?
My films have been pretty, scrappy indies. So I'd like to kind of like take a step up in budget and not have to shoot a feature film in 16 days. But ever since I was that young queer kid in Ohio, I've been obsessed with Mae West. And, I mentioned it to, I'm a film teacher, and I mentioned her name to my students. They have no idea who she is.
How is that possible?
I don't know. Anybody under the age of 50 seems to not know who she is. I mean, there are some younger women that know. And when I mention it, they're like, oh, she was a badass, you know? But my mission is to make people know who she is. I've written a biopic called Sex with Mae West, which is kind of the origin story of how she came up with the character that we know of. And, oh, why don't you come up and see me sometime? You know, like all of that stuff. She was influenced by lots of different cultures, Black culture, queer culture, street culture, and her mother, and sort of, created this amazing, iconic rebel who really was rebelling against the patriarchy by feeling comfortable in her own sexuality and sort of flaunting it and also making fun of it with a wink and a nod. So Mae West was always like my spirit animal or my idol, even before Stevie Nicks and Annie Lennox and all of those people. So I'm trying to get a biopic made of her life.
And what does Mae West have in common with your prior subjects or prior protagonists?
I sort of joke with my husband, Tim, that I'm just remaking a film that I did called Gypsy 83, or that maybe all my films are remakes of each other, just in different ways. You know, a lot of them deal with the same themes. But I mean, this was a woman who had tried to make it in vaudeville and tried to follow her dreams since she was 5 years old and got into her 30s and got banned from vaudeville from doing this crazy suggestive dance called the shimmy. Her career was basically at an end until her mother encouraged her to write her own plays. And a lot of it is a battle of confidence, you know, with like, you think I can really write? And her own self-esteem, because Mae West was not the most, you know, she was a voluptuous woman. She struggled with her weight. She, you know, was beautiful, but not conventionally. She learned from drag queens how to make herself feel beautiful and sort of accept herself and revel in herself. I think maybe that's the thing that relates to my other films, this person that is trying to follow a dream and sort of needs to accept who they are in order to get there.
And so since we're talking about the future and the totality of your work, if you were to use three words to describe your films and you as a filmmaker, what are the first three words that might come to mind?
Pride, rebellion, I don't know. You know, this is, it's another word just popped into my head. I was teaching my students how to design like a look of a film. And so I showed them trailers of all my films to give examples of different looks. And one of my students said something interesting, which is that, you know, he said, I see like a commonality in all your work. Like I said, that's really funny because I don't, as a director, I don't feel like I have one look or one kind of thing, you know, like a lot of directors, like you could tell it's a Quentin Tarantino movie or whatever it is. And I said, you really think there's some commonality? And he said, yeah, sadness. And I was just like, wow, man, really? So I think there's a melancholy, bittersweet quality about my work. Like one of the albums I'm listening to musically right now is Songs of a Lost World by The Cure, which is like Robert Smith is to me one of the greatest like songwriters of our time. But The Cure has that happy, sad thing where there's, you know, it's like crying on the dance floor kind of thing. It's like that there's like a joy to it, but also like kind of a sadness or a melancholy. And I've sort of realized that that's sort of my strength, you know, that's like what my best area to lead from. And that circles back to the music. A lot of that comes from the music that I listen to. But okay, sadness. I guess that's the third one.
Okay. Pride, rebellion, and sad.
Yeah. So
what aspect of pride, how are you using the word pride?
I think self-acceptance, you know, self-love, like finding kind of what we were talking about with Mae West. And Gypsy 83 went on the same journey. That's a film that I'm working on the director's cut of, which is going to come out in 2025 for its 25th anniversary. I didn't even realize that. Yeah, it's a person that isn't perfect or has flaws, or sometimes the biggest antagonist is in their own mind, and who go on a journey of sort of feeling, accepting themselves and learning to feel proud about who they are despite their faults. And so, yeah, that's how I would call pride.
And how are you using the word rebellion?
Well, that's, you know, speaking of Gypsy 83, it was my biggest like flop that I've made commercially.
So far, be optimistic. The biggest flop so far.
Girl, oh my God. It was like made 25 years ago. And it was the story of this queer goth boy and his best friend, who was a straight woman, that learned about this thing called Night of a Thousand Stevies, which is Night of a Thousand Stevie Nicks. And they ran away from Ohio to go to New York City to be part of Night of a Thousand Stevies. Anyway, it was really like an intimate relationship between like a gay man and a straight female ally, which hadn't really been done much at the time. It was really hard to get it distributed because at the time, you know, queer content, thank God things have changed to some extent, but queer content was pretty much just marketed to gay people. Like it was either a gay male film or like a lesbian film. And the gay male films were sold by putting like two hot guys, you know, without their shirts on the movie poster. The distributors at the time said, you know, comparing it to Edge of 17, Gypsy 83 is not gay enough. Besides, who wants to see a fag hag movie, they said. But I was horrified. And I thought I was trying to make a film that was branching out from just the confines of the queer audience and sort of crossing over, which was something we always longed for at the time, which was hard to do. But the challenge of hearing, you know, this film isn't gay enough, made me so mad that I thought, you know what? I'm going to make the gayest film ever made in the history of the world. And I'm going to like kind of flip the bird in your face at the same time. And that's what Another Gay Movie was, you know. It was just really like rebellion. On the other hand, it was in this world where none of the conflict of the movie was about being gay, you know. I like to call it like post-gay in a way, like post-coming out, kind of looping back to what you were talking about before, where so many queer films, it's like the big conflict is that they're gay. In another gay movie, the conflict was they wanted to get laid just like everybody else at 17. You know what I mean? And they were young and stupid and made mistakes. It was like a film that was making where I wanted to make fun of myself and ourselves as queer people and finally be able to like laugh at ourselves. Because up until that point, everything was so serious.
Earnest.
Yeah. And by doing that film was kind of like an act of rebellion. I remember it premiered at Tribeca and going into the restroom stall and hearing these two boyfriends like at the urinal peeing, like arguing about the film. And one thought it was the most brilliant thing in the world. And the other said it would set the queer movement back like 50 years. And, you know. And that made me so happy because it's like I knew I was like pressing buttons and sparking a conversation, which was my intent with the film. So, yeah, that was the rebellious side of my Gemini self.
Post-gay. So instead of Beyond the Thunderdome, Beyond the Rollerdrome or something like that.
Exactly.
When that student talked about sadness, I would nuance that and say tenacious. Because I do think the protagonists of your film suffer setbacks, but I would say they believe in the trajectory of their own life enough to eventually stay the course and become more of whom they authentically are. And I know that's what seeing your films 25 years ago helped give me permission to do. So I'm very grateful.
Thank you. Thank you. But I do believe in that tenacious quest to be who we are. Sometimes we lose things along the way or there's certain sacrifices, you know, and I like to end my films not with everything tied up in a bow, but to kind of capture more real life. And there's always that hope, you know, but at the end of Edge of 17, he's lost kind of his best friend and his relationship with his mother is unclear where that's going to go. But we hope that things will get better. And in real life, they did. You know, my mom is still here, thank God. And she's amazing. My friend Maggie, got all past that. So time can heal for sure.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our time together during this episode. Thank you so much, Todd.
Thank you, Greg. It's great to be here.
I think your new DJ name is Tenacious T, just so you know. And thank you, too, to the listeners. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Travels with Triggs.
Travels with Triggs. Who's he gonna talk to now? What's he gonna talk about? Where we gonna go? Travels with Triggs.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we're all about the Mediterranean diet and how delicious and easy it can be to make a part of your life. We're talking to Susie Carace of The Mediterranean Dish, and we have a deep dive into olive oil with a trained olive oil sommelier, Claudia Hanna. It's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, millions of Americans think they are allergic to penicillin, and the vast majority of them are not.
90% of people who believe that they are allergic to penicillin actually can tolerate it.
And why do these misdiagnoses matter?
We would save millions of dollars, just my healthcare system. So it must be in the billions.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
On last week's Wait, Don't Tell Me, our panel took on the Village People performing their hit YMCA at the inauguration.
They also said that this is the last living member.
Yes.
So it's just Y.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the show that's not so much about why as WTF. This week with special guest musician MXM Tune from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.